quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
Hello, you're listening to the podcast, So There I Was. It's how all great aviation tales begin. This is episode 98. I lived. Now I got to do it again.
Yo, that was a great story.
That was a great story. Holy smokes. Opens with a bit of a tease on there.
Yeah.
Wandering around the flight deck of an aircraft carrier, you know, because you can.
Not, you know, very unique experience. What a great guest, Hoover.
Yeah, right.
Air Force F-15 pilot that ended up doing an exchange tour with the Marines, and that's how he got carrier called. Let's just leave it at that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's bang out a couple admin items here, Fig. We got a new 5-star rating this week that I'd like to tell everybody about, because, you know, we're trainable. So when we get these 5 stars, we thrive on that stuff. Outstanding. This podcast is outstanding. It has great stories from outstanding military men and women. You will definitely laugh a lot and learn a lot. Check it out. Semper Fi, Scotty Southard, a.k.a. Pre-Flight. Indeed. Yeah. Thanks. One of the listeners we picked up from the Mac Geek Gab. You'd think I'd learn to be able to say that after having co-hosted that show.
Mac Geek Gab.
There you go.
Thanks, Pre-Flight.
Indeed.
Also, we have a new section lead.
Yeah.
Sean Moody Blues. Thank you, Sean. Call sign Moody. Thank you so much.
Well,
very humbly.
Let's go with call sign Blues.
Sean Moody, call sign Blues.
Yeah. Moody Blues.
Hey, you know what? I'm tradable. It's been a long day, bro. It's been a long day.
Right,
Sean,
on.
Sean, yeah. Moody Blues. Yeah, call sign Blues.
It has been a long day. It's after 10 o'clock on the East Coast. After having flown in from Europe and been up all day, we wound up in late. And this has just been a long day. But it was a great show. Opened up with a tease about being out on an aircraft carrier. And, of course, everybody who's on an aircraft carrier deck has been there before and has been trained to be there. Not the case when your background is a Strike Eagle.
No, it's a very hazardous environment. So just getting to the airplane, getting to your airplane on the deck of an operating aircraft carrier is, well, it's hazardous, for crying out loud.
It is. It is hazardous to your health. It's a good way to die.
Yeah.
So, but some really great stories. Almost a show title was, I did get kicked out of flight training.
Yeah, terrifying, terrifying story.
Gosh. Yeah. He was kicked out of flight training. Listen, you'll hear it.
Yeah. So. And, you know, his story about how he got his call sign, which, you know, he downplayed before we
did. Oh, yeah,
it's not real funny.
You know, it's.
I felt like I did 1,000 crunches after he told that story out loud.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was awesome. The other thing that we need to tell you, Pilot Debrief on YouTube. That's his channel, Pilot Debrief. He did some safety work in the Air Force, and that led him to an interest, and people would ask him about it. So he created a channel, much like Blanco Lirio or Scott Perdue. He does post-mishap analysis, and he has several shorts up there as well, 60 seconds or less, that are a little more lighthearted, but great, great content. Go check it out. And the reason I mention that is twofold. One, because I want you to go look at his stuff, but two, he was another great broadcaster. He puts us to shame.
Yeah, he did. You know, a great interview.
Yeah,
great stories, well spoken. You know, he had 2200 plus hours in tactical jets, retired out of the Air Force, did the exchange tour with the Marines. Very unique opportunity for him, and boy, he had some, well, he had a great perspective about it.
Did indeed. And we found out which child was his favorite.
Yeah, no surprise there. What do you say we get out of the way and let this thing rip?
Let's do it. Here comes Hoover.
Don't sit on the ejection seat handle, by the way.
Don't do it, especially not when you're going to get shot off the nose of a carrier.
This here is a true story about crossing the pond at night in the world's smallest cockpit on the tanker through the weather. Oh, and to the tanker crew who did that, thanks a lot. We really appreciated that. I'm just kidding. No, I'm not. Well, there I was crossing the pond, and you could see that I wasn't exactly fun.
So there I was, an Air Force guy, finding myself walking out on the carrier deck and being told, go find your aircraft and go take off. I'm thinking to myself, what the hell have I gotten myself into?
Well, that is a great, so there I was, opener. Welcome, everyone. This is Fig coming to you from, well, hell, I'm in Denver, Colorado today. Where's my cohorst?
Greetings, everyone. Repeat here, coming to you live from Indianapolis. So, and that is the voice you heard of. Some of you may recognize his voice from his channel, which is Pilot Debrief on YouTube. Call sign Hoover, one of the few Air Force Eagle drivers to carrier qualify and fly Hornets with the Marine Corps. Welcome, Hoover. We're thrilled that you could join us tonight. And up front, thank you for being so flexible with our screwed up schedules.
Yes, thanks, Hoover.
I'm glad to be a part of this.
Okay, I want to go. I want to get the rest of that, but we'll get to that because I knew your background, but that's pretty awesome.
We always have to start at the beginning. How'd you get started flying? What was it that piqued your interest in airplanes, and how'd you get there from here?
Well, so when I was a kid, I always wanted to be an astronaut, and then I found out you have to do more advanced math to figure out how to do that stuff.
There's the rub, right there.
So, hey. Eventually made my way off to the Air Force Academy, and that's where, you know, I got about through a freshman year of trying to do calculus and said, all right, that's enough. And I tapped out of that and said, well, I guess we'll just stick with the regular flying instead of pursuing that engineering degree and doing everything else that you need to become a test pilot and go down that path. So, but yeah, I mean, back when I was a kid, I used to always just draw pictures of the shuttle and, you know, always had that sort of interest, but no one in my family ever served in the military. And we lived in Tampa, and we'd go down to the air shows at MacDill Air Force Base there and see, you know, the aircraft down there. And so that kind of got me started on that path.
And not far from the launches. Did you ever go to a launch?
No, but you could see them from where we were, you know, across the state there. And I still remember being, I think I was in, it was either third or fourth grade, going outside and then watching the Challenger, you know, break apart.
Oh, shit.
So that's something I'll never forget, you know, and like, and as elementary school kids, like you're kind of like, you don't really understand what's happening until, you know, years later, the gravity of the situation. But yeah, that's something I'll never forget, seeing that happen live.
Right. That's one of those moments in American history where people know exactly where they were. So
where were you, repeat?
I was driving through the back gate at Cherry Point. I was a firing platoon commander in the Hawk Missile Battery, and I was on my way back from a morning break. I think I'd been out PTing or something. For some reason, I was at the house, and I was on my way back to the battalion, and heard it on the radio as I was driving through the gate. So it was horrendous. How about you?
I was walking through the student union in college, my senior year, and I saw it happen live on the big screen there. And I was like, oh, shit, that's not good.
Terrible.
Right.
One of the reasons I asked you about had you ever gone to a launch, I did have the privilege of going to a launch many years later. A friend of mine, another one, was on Columbia, and we went down to that launch. 3 miles away, the deep resonance of the thumping that was going through my chest as that thing was lifting off the pad and going into outer space was one of the most impressive demonstrations of man-made power I've ever seen in my life heretofore. So anyway, well, happy times. What a great subject to start off.
So I obviously I heard you say Air Force Academy, Hoover.
Yeah.
And then their pilot training, and obviously you went the fighter route.
Yeah, after the academy, I ended up doing a year on casual status, waiting to go to pilot training.
I was
over in Ramstein, where I flew with the C-9 squadron, which was probably one of the greatest assignments that I ever had. You know, young second lieutenant with no responsibility, and here you're gonna, you know, you don't need to be qualified on the aircraft. We just need you to go along with us, and you can work the oven and cook the meals. You know,
did you bounce around Europe in the C-9?
Yeah, yeah. So we went all over the place. So they do all the air medical evacuation stuff. So during the time I was there, the biggest thing they responded to was the USS Cole bombing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I didn't go on that mission because being a non, you know, working crew member or whatever, but
right.
They have pretty big mission set over there with standard routes, you know, to Sigonella and Aviano and over to Incirlik and stuff like that. So it was a good exposure.
That would have been fall of 2001, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a good exposure, you know, coming out of the Air Force Academy to what a flying squadron was like on the, at least on the non-fighter side. And then off I went to pilot training. And then, like you said, I wanted to fly helicopters because I just thought that was kind of cool. But I think I was also probably being heavily influenced by the fact
Sticks
that...
Sticks giving the high sign in the background there.
Yeah. Sticks is in the background doing push-ups. And I don't know. He's going crazy. That's awesome.
So we had two of my T-37 instructors were MH-53 guys. That did all, you know, the spec ops stuff. And so they had all these cool stories that they would tell us. Like, man, this sounds really awesome. I should maybe go do that. Cause that sounded a lot funner than, you know, flying around in a C-9.
Well,
and eventually, you know, about halfway through the T-37 training, I had some friends that were over flying the T-38s on the fighter track. And they were like, no, man, this is way cooler. Come do this. And so that's the direction I went. And then, got a very fortunate enough to, you know, pick up a Strike Eagle slot, and then that's how I got started.
Awesome. Well,
nice. What a beast that airplane is too, huh? Yeah. The Strike Eagle. Oh, I don't, no, Fig, do you remember the first time you saw an eagle?
Yeah, I do.
Up close?
Well, you mean air to air? You mean like...
Yeah, well, no, just walking around. The first time I ever saw one on the ramp was, I was actually at Fatima at the air show out on...
Dude, yes, I was there with you.
Yeah.
We were there together.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Yes, walked up and yes, I'm like, yes. Oh my God, that's a monster airplane. I had no idea how big the Eagle was.
It was like a F-14 size.
Strike.
I mean, yeah. You know, it was like as big as a tennis court practically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's cool. But you didn't have any fun flying that, did you?
No, probably not. No.
That was a blast. That first assignment was, I mean, everybody remembers their first assignment, you know?
Sure.
The friendships that you make and you kind of going through that whole process, you know, becoming part of a fighter squadron and deployments and things like that. And so,
right.
So yeah, it was,
where's the training for that?
Seymour Johnson, North Carolina.
Okay.
And so, then did you stay there or where were you based in your first?
So I started there. And then the second assignment was the Hornet exchange assignment that I did. And then I ended up after that, I went back to the Strike Eagle before they finally decided that was enough flight time for me and I needed to go to school and learn how to be an officer or something like that. And so I did that for a little bit.
Sticks in the mud.
So you, in your first tour, how long did you get to fly in your first squadron?
I left that first assignment with just over 1,000 hours in the Strike Eagle.
Over
that 3-year period, yeah.
Oh, wow. Damn. Well, you're getting a lot of, that's good flying.
Yeah, it was we did two combat deployments during that time. And so there was a lot of close air support, you know, and we were flying out of Qatar up into Iraq, you know, and so those were, you know, usually like 6-8 hour missions, you know, so you build up the hours pretty quick.
I'm trying to think. I don't think there were F-15Es there when I was there in 2015. When were you there? What years? What years was your first deployment?
First deployment was in 2004.
Okay.
And then the second one was in the spring of 2006.
Wow, that's pretty quick turnaround time for you guys.
Yeah. But back then we weren't, so the Air Force, you know, they eventually went to the whole 6-month deployment thing. But back then we were only doing, you know, the 90 to 120 day.
Oh, wow. Even active duty guys were doing
deployment
that?
Deployment time, yeah.
Shh.
Yeah, wow. So that wasn't...
That's a good deal.
So it wasn't bad.
No.
No, that's outstanding. That's outstanding.
Go ahead, brother.
I was just going to ask, so how much time did you wind up total in the Eagle, in the Hornet?
When it was combined, all said and done? My total flight time over the military is just, I think, a little over 2,000 hours, like 2,200, 2,300, something like that.
Yeah. You know,
I ended up having, you know, I didn't get a lot of time in the Hornet, which you might not be surprised, but, you know, maintenance is not as the same kind of standard that they do in the Air Force, and the funding isn't the best. But then, you know, it was after that third flying assignment, going to school and then doing a staff job. And then, you know, and then I ended up doing a remote over to Korea. So I ended up out of the cockpit for about 5 years.
Oh, geez.
During my 20-year timeline. So, yeah, it was painful.
Watching your plane fly going, I know.
No, how to that's do rough. That. Okay. So I want to back up just a second, Hoover.
Yeah.
When you were in flight school, T-37s and T-38s, and then the, what do you guys call the blue T-38s? Maybe that's changed. So once you got.
Yeah. So let
me get straight to the point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was there any excitement in flight training that sticks in your mind? You're like, oh shit, I remember this one time. So there was this one time. So there I was. I mean, do you have any of those in flight training?
I do. They're not, I would say, flying related.
That's okay.
I'll share one story because I did get kicked out of pilot training for about a period of about 12 to 18 hours.
Okay. Ooh. So this is worth a stag. Okay.
There may be a show title there. I did get kicked out of flight training.
Yeah. So this is, when I was doing the T-38 thing, I was the class leader because I was the highest ranking guy in the class at the time. And so we had a trip that we were supposed to go on up to the centrifuge to do that stuff, you know, and then come back, and it was over the weekend. And so we drove up there as a class. I think we had like a government van or something, but anyways, I won't talk about what happened while we were on that trip.
Damn it.
but I will say that when we came back, we had some stuff with us that we acquired along the way from some various places that we frequented while we were there.
Ah,
and
there you go.
As we're pulling back into the parking lot, as we're getting close to the base, I got this phone call, and it was from the flight commander. And, you know, hey, how'd the trip go? You know, you guys heard you're coming back, you know, this afternoon. I said, yeah, we'll be back in a couple hours. So, okay, great. Cause the squadron commander would like to see you in his office as soon as you get back. You know, don't bother going to your dorm room. Just come straight in and report into his office. This is like a Sunday afternoon. I'm like,
okay, that's not
thinking
good.
Like, well, what did the guys in the other van do that I don't know about?
Yeah.
That I'm about to find out when I walk into the boss's office.
He's not hanging in his office on a Sunday night afternoon for grins.
No. Yeah. Well, and I kind of asked that question. It was like, is there anything I should be concerned? Oh no. He just wants to chat. You know.
Sure he does.
You know, of course, you know, it's not really what that meeting's going to be about. So. I'll never forget, you know, just kind of we pulled into the parking lot, and I told my buddies, I was like, all right, I got to walk into the office. You guys take whatever's in these vans. I don't want to know about it. Get it out of here. Go on your way. And I'm going to have plausible deniability over this whole thing.
These aren't the drugs you're looking
at. Because that's what I thought it was about. You know, maybe the guys did something, you know, on the trip that I wasn't aware of. And I walk into that office there, and he's got the lights off, and he's sitting there in the dark behind his desk. And there's like the glow of the computer screen on his face, you know, and, you know, kind of, you know, half like, should I report in or should I just, you know, what should I do? You know, I walk in there and he doesn't want me to sit down. He's like, stand right here. You know, it's like, and then he starts off this, you know, like, I just want to let you know how utterly disgusted I am right now. And he says, as of this moment, you are no longer in pilot training. And I need you to go back to your dorm room. You're going to find a letter from the OSI, which is the Office of Special Investigations, for those who don't know. So you're going to find a letter from the OSI. They've confiscated some things from your room, including your computer. And, you know, there'll be instructions in that letter for what you're supposed to do, and we'll go from there. But we're done talking, and you can go ahead and leave now.
See, so he did just want to chat, and you listen.
Yes.
This sounds more treacherous than just some small antics.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, like, what in the world is going on? So I called my buddy at the dorm who lived across the hall from me. I'm like, hey, man, did anybody come by my room this weekend? She's like, no, what are you talking about? I'm like, okay. So I make my way over there and I open my door and everything's in place. My computer's there. There's no letter. And I'm like dumbfounded. I'm like, I don't know what to do now. You know,
are you getting punked? Are you thinking there's got to be a mistake at this point, right?
Yeah.
So I call my flight commander, who was the one that originally called me, told me about the meeting. And I said, hey boss, you know, like I went and I met with the boss and he told me I was kicked out and there's stuff in my room and stuff missing, but I came back to my room. There's nothing here. There's no letter. I don't know what's going on. You know, what am I supposed to do? And then I get the, hold on, I'll be right over. I'm like, oh crap, you know? And so now he's coming over. He gets there. He kind of walks up to my room, looks around. He's like, all right, I'll be back. And then he takes off.
Okay.
And doesn't explain to me what's going on. So I'm just kind of left standing there.
So is he a major, lieutenant colonel?
He's a captain. The squadron commander was the lieutenant colonel. So no five.
Okay.
And to make a long story short, you know, a few minutes later, you know, he shows back up in the parking lot. He's like, all right, I talked to the squadron commander here. You need to talk to him. And he like puts me on the phone with him. And squadron commander is like, he says, what's, I forget his exact words, but it was something like, what's your first name? You know,
there's more than one of you.
Up to this point, and I'm not going to say, but up to this point, I was just lieutenant, you know, so-and-so,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know,
John Doe, you're Lieutenant Doe.
It turns out there's a lot of Joneses or Smiths or, you know, whatever.
Right. Yes. Okay.
And so I tell him my first name. He's all right. I'll call you back. A few minutes more goes by. He calls back. All right. Disregard everything I said. You know, you're going to show up tomorrow and we'll figure out the paperwork, you know, and we're going to go from there. And that was the end of it. And it was still Sunday afternoon, you know, and I guess they had already done up some paperwork because the next day when I came in, like I had to sign some forms and do some stuff. And then it was probably about later that afternoon where the wing commander, so the guy in charge of the base, the 06, wanted to meet with me and apologize on behalf of everybody. As it turns out, there was another lieutenant who had the same last name as me, who had been involved in
some fairly nefarious things.
Yeah, apparently. Let's just say it's just extremely inappropriate type of activities that would have been on his computer.
Oh boy. Okay.
You know, and so that was, I mean, it was one of the scariest moments I had in pilot training that didn't have to do with flying.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
Well, that's totally, you know, understandable.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was kicked out. And then the funny thing was that wing commander, he ended up being the wing commander at Seymour Johnson while I was there. And so I got to run into him again. And I remember I had a few too many drinks at the O Club when I did. And I said, hey, you remember me? I was that guy you got kicked out.
You kicked me out for 18 hours.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, that's a story with a happy ending, and I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah. But who needs laxatives when you get a chat like that from?
Well, you know, I feel like, you know, my entire flying career, I was just extremely fortunate that I never found myself in any type of, you know, situation where I felt, you know, really unsafe or had some sort of complex emergency. That the closest thing I had to a complex emergency was we had an AMAD fire. You know, it's a airframe mounted accessory drive, you know, that connects the generator and the engine, or whatever, and then the strike eagle. So we had one of those fires, but it happened after like a 7-hour mission over in Iraq, and we had landed and we had, you know, taxied back in and we were about to shut down in the chucks when the thing lit off.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
And so the timing of it just happened to work out. Like, it was the best timing possible for something to catch on fire, you know, and it was actually a pretty good sized fire, but,
that's a good place to have it in the chalks, you know,
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, other than that, you know, you talk to all these guys that, you know, live through, you know, some pretty crazy stuff or had really weird things happen to them. And like I said, I think it was just very fortunate. So a lot of my flying stories aren't necessarily flying stories. They were just kind of crazy stuff that happened over the years.
Yeah, that was, you know, most of my stories that I tell are not really flying related. They're in off duty hours. Let's just put it that way.
As long as only 10% is true, you're good.
You know? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And as
that's right.
Yeah. And as Gallo put it, there's plenty of good war stories ruined by an eyewitness. So
that's right.
So, wow. And so it lit off in Iraq. That reminds me, a friend of mine was a Massachusetts Guard, a National Guard, did a pump over in Iraq. And he said, talking about being there in the summer. And he goes, well, you ever walk through jet exhaust? I go, yeah. He goes, well, in Iraq, it actually cools you down. So I see the fire lighting off, expected. But.
All right, Hoover, you have a call sign Hoover. How'd that come about? And is it vacuum related?
It is not vacuum related.
Okay.
And the other question I get is there's two other questions. I'm either somehow related to Bob Hoover.
Right.
Or it has something to do with Animal House.
Right.
And it's none of those.
Well, damn it.
Surprisingly.
Well, there's no eyewitnesses here, man. Make it sexy.
So the story goes, you know, at Seymour, I did, you know, the initial training, the Strike Eagle, and they have four squadrons there. You got two training units and then two operational squadrons. And since I was stationed there, you just kind of walk across the street to your operational squadron, bring all your flight gear with you. And so at some point when I dropped off my flight gear, it got mixed up with somebody else's, right? So when I went into the life support shop to do that initial fit check on everything, went to put on my G-suit. It had been maybe like a month, you know, because they kind of give you some time off after training. I went in and like the G-suit was just, you know, probably about five sizes way too big. And, you know, so the tech, he's sitting there trying to like cinch it down. And he's like, sir, this is like, I can't, you know, this thing's way too big. We're going to have to get a smaller size. And then, you know, and then this starts into the joke of like, you know, cause like I'm a pretty skinny guy. And back then I was a little bit skinnier, you know? Shit. And so he's like, what happened to you, dude?
Right.
What's that?
What is he like, dude, did you get a tapeworm in the last month? What happened to you?
Well, so that starts in his joke of, you know, like, well, sir, like I don't know if they make a male G suit this small, we're going to have to get a female G suit, you know? And so
that's not good.
And so it and then this turns it, you know, which there's no such thing. It's just all, you know, G suit, whatever. And then, but there was a female in the squadron who happened to be in there at the time, and she had overheard all this.
Oh boy.
And so she, you know, as clever and as funny as most fighter pilots are, you know, decided that she would go around the squadron saying like, hey, that new guy that just showed up, did you hear he wears a female G or female flight suits? Because he likes the way they're form fitting, you know. So he's actually a cross dresser. and so this went on for a while because like back, you know, this was like 20 years ago. So people didn't really talk about that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And so people, you know, so I'd get these weird looks sometimes from people in the squadron because like you could tell they were thinking it, but they didn't want to say anything or ask me about it, you know. And then eventually like people started asking me, they were like, who's going to ask him, you know? And then somebody would ask me like, hey man, like I heard you wear female flight suits. Like what's the deal with that? You know, like, does the zipper go all the way around or like how does that work? You know? Where are you guys hearing this? You know, like, no, like I don't wear chick flight suits, you know, like,
yeah, what the hell?
And so that went on for a little while. And then, you know, of course we ended up, they wanted to wait until we did the naming, until we were on a deployment. And so we go on the deployment, and unfortunately some things happened on that deployment that made it turn out to be a dry deployment where they took away all the booze from us. So the naming wasn't as creative as it could have been, but we had this story about, you know, here's this guy, he's potentially a cross dresser. And so somebody said, well, hey, J. Edgar Hoover was a cross dresser and nobody
knew about that. Oh, there you go. Okay.
So that's where Hoover came from.
That's, okay. Well, you know what? I guess it could have been a lot worse. That's a great story. Thank you.
That is actually really good. Yeah, that's in it.
I'll tell you what, I was there for a second and I got about 100 crunches worth of laughing in right there. So I appreciate that.
Well, you know, the thing about fighter pilots, as you guys know, is as long as you tell something with a certain air of credibility, you know.
Oh yeah.
And you're, you know, as long as you make it believe, people believe you. They're like, yeah, like that makes sense. You know, so and she was really good about convincing people.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's with the zipper? Does it go all the way around or what? What's the deal? That's rich. Oh man, that's awesome. Okay. So you know, so no drama, no air drama, nothing, no good combat stories from your first couple pumps over there or,
you know,
anything memorable?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So the first deployment we were over there, it was actually the second deployment, but most of the time we were over there, it ended up being, you know, kind of slow because, you know, OIF, it would kind of come and go in waves depending on what the guys on the ground were doing. And, you know, if your timing was off as a squadron, you know, there just wasn't a lot going on. But one of the times we were over there, I was a flight lead. And so we were taking the formation up. We were supposed to do our standard, you know, what they called recce or what's it called? convoy support, you know, scanning the route in front of the convoy, right?
Sure.
In the middle of the night. And you're not working with somebody in the convoy. You're working with somebody back in the talk, you know, who's talking on HF or something else with somebody else on the convoy, you know, so third party relay type stuff.
Yeah. How could that not get screwed up, right?
Well, the thing is like, you know, these type of missions, really what it was is, you know, they wanted us on call in case, you know, troops in contact or something kicked off. And so they'd assign us to cover these convoys just to give us something to do because there wasn't anything else for us to do. There weren't any enough missions going on. And, you know, it's one of these things, okay, well, we want you to scan out in front of the convoy. We want you to, you know, tell us if you see any bad guys out there, you know, type of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And you never find anybody. But sure enough, flying along 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever, you know, my wizzo is like, I got something, you know, and all of a sudden the excitement kicks off and he found a guy on the side of the road. It was around the bend from where the convoy was headed. And you could tell that, you know, with the MVGs, you can kind of see some of the convoy lights and stuff. But as soon as the convoy kind of came around the corner, that guy, we watched him in the targeting pod. He dropped everything that he was doing. He was digging something on the side of the road and he dropped it. And he, not only did he run across the street, but he jumped in a ditch. We had like a little stream and he swam across that. And then he got into the field and then he started running again. And we're like, okay, like that's not normal.
No,
you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, you know? So, so we had to wait for the process of, you know, relaying to try to get the convoy to stop. So we're screaming at the, you know, at the guy on the radio, trying to get him to yell at the convoy to stop, eventually get the convoy to stop. And then now this starts this, you know, this long process of, okay, well now we got to verify what it is while at the same time keeping track of this guy as he's going through the field so we can satisfy rules of engagement, making sure we have 100% positive ID of him from the time we found him all the way up until that point. And as we're doing that, we're waiting for somebody from the convoy now to walk out in front to see what it was. And sure enough, he had been planting an IED, trying to ambush those guys. And so, and of course, in the middle of all of that, I'm having to coordinate, you know, for a refueling asset to come in, you know, to give us some more gas. And of course, there's weather, you know, so we're dealing with that too and trying to figure that out. But it worked out, and eventually, to much to my surprise, they eventually gave us authorization to strike. Cause at that point, like the ROE in the theater was starting to change. It was becoming more conservative,
yes.
You know, where like, okay, well, if you're not actually being shot at, then we're not going to let you shoot back at somebody, you know, but they let us. And so we were able to take care of the threat that was no longer a threat at the time, but definitely would have been a threat in the future.
This sounds like a process that was not expedient. Could you just guess at the timeline from the initial contact with this, you saw this person until he actually went kinetic?
It was long enough where I sent my wingman off to the tanker because I knew we were going to have to do what we call yo-yo ops, which for those that don't know, you know, you're over there is a two ship. So you send one jet to the tanker. So that way when he comes back, you can go. So that way you're always leaving one jet on station to provide the coverage. So it was long enough for me to coordinate for a tanker and then for me to send my wingman to the tanker for him to refuel and then come back. And then as he was coming back, we were getting set up for our strike. And then we were able to hang out a little bit longer. And then I left him on station for me to go to the tanker. So it was a while.
Holy cow. It's the wheels of administration. That's frustrating.
Yeah.
Yep. Wow. And so as average sortie in combat for you guys, how long was that from, well, just for our purposes here, from the time you briefed until you got back and debriefed, what kind of day are we talking?
Most of the sorties over in Iraq were about 7 hours, I would say. I had a couple that were like 9 to 10 hours, just depending on what's going on. And then, you know, but
that'll flatten your backside. Damn.
The briefing and the debriefing for those are definitely, they're much different than the brief and debrief that we do stateside for training missions, you know, because so your overall day though was, you know, it was probably about 10 to 12 hours though. I mean, so, but it's not terrible, but you know, if you're doing that, you know, 4 times a week, like it can get, it can get tiring.
Yeah. Yeah. Where were you based when you were over there?
I was in LUD at Qatar. Okay. For both of those deployments. I never did the Afghanistan thing. So some guys did that. That was a little bit different flying over there, but.
All right. So did you volunteer for an exchange tour, or did somebody come to you and say, you need to do this? How did that come about?
I volunteered. I wanted to do it.
Nice.
So when I was on my second deployment in the Strike Eagle, we had a female WISO in our squadron whose husband was a F-18D WISO with the Marine Corps.
Okay.
And he was stationed up in, where were they stationed up at? They were stationed somewhere up in Iraq, you know, operating out of there while we were stationed down at Al-Udeid. And when the assignment cycle came out, you know, for here's the list of potential assignments. I think there was like an F-22 exchange or not exchange, an F-22 transition and then some other stuff. And then there was this thing, you know, it said F-18D exchange program Marine Corps. And I'm like, man, this sounds really cool. You know, like it's doing the same mission I already really enjoy doing, you know, providing the support to the guys on the ground and doing that stuff. And I knew that the Marines were doing a lot more of it than what we were doing. And they tended to be operating under not a different set of rules, but I'd say more flexible set of rules than the Air Force guys were, you know.
Yeah, I want to talk about that.
I mean, so talking to her and her husband, you know, and kind of, you know, getting a feel for that, it I was kind of like, yeah, I definitely want to do this. And I knew I could. They were also doing the FAC-A mission, so the forward air controller stuff.
Yep.
And so I wanted to do that. I thought that would be really cool. That's something the Strike Eagle doesn't do. And so, yeah, so I put it down as my first choice and it worked out.
Okay. So you went to where for F-18 training?
So I went straight from Seymour out to Miramar to do the RAG.
VMFAT 101.
Yeah. 101. Yeah. Sharpshooters out there. So I did that for a year. And initially, I didn't think I was going to do the carrier call stuff because I knew I was going to a D-model squadron, which the Marine Corps D-model squadrons, they don't go to the boat, you know, when they deploy. So I didn't know that was going to happen, but, it was kind of cool to find out that, hey, you know, we're going to go ahead and put you through this anyways. So, yeah, so I spent a year out there, and we can talk more about that in a second. But then after that, I went over to Beaufort, South Carolina, for VMFA 533 with the Hawks to your assignment with them.
And so was your experience at VMFAT 101 your first experience being around Navy Marines?
Naval Radiators.
What I'm digging at is what was your – because, you know, you alluded to it a little bit. What was your – How can I say
the the different impressions of what it was like to fly Air Force versus Navy. There's actually two of you sitting here tonight that have done both. Finished up doing Air Guard. So
I mean, I understand. You know, I started, you know, in the Marines, and then when I transitioned to Air Force rules, I was, you know, having been brought up one way, I was constantly frustrated at the at the operating restrictions that were put on us in training. And I found it ironic that when we deployed to combat, everything was waived. Whereas, you know, the way we were brought up, you know, there was no restrictions. And when you went to combat, that's how you operated every day. It was a little different, philosophical, I guess. how did you feel about that? Or, you know, what was your impression? Did you think, holy shit, these guys are a bunch of freaking cowboys? Or was it like, okay, I can.
It was interesting because, you know, the Air Force is, you know, everything from pilot training all the way, you know, through your initial training, a fighter squadron, it's just very regimented. You know, you've got your set hours, you've got, you know, this is going to happen this, right. This is the schedule. Like, there's no like really deviating from that schedule, you know? And then you show up there, you know, for training with the Hornet. And it's like, it's like typical naval training, you know, where you're kind of like, oh, well, here's what you're supposed to do. It's up to you to go do it, you know, and figure this out, you know, and no, we don't have any class on this because you're supposed to go study on your own type thing, you know? And then just the way they manage the schedule to everything else, it is completely just so different from how the Air Force is,
right.
Air Force manages stuff. And I mean, I remember at one point I had gone, I think about 3 weeks without flying and, you know, but I didn't know who to talk to or whatever. And like, I'm like, all right, like this is enough. Like, and I walked, you're not supposed to walk into the scheduling shop as a student, but I had a little bit more leeway being, you know, like not really a true student since I'd already had operational experience. So I walk in there. I'm like, hey, what's going on, man? Like I haven't flown, you know, in a couple of weeks, you know, it's been almost 3 weeks. And they look, they're like, well, we don't see your puck on the board. Well, somebody had knocked my stupid pucks off the board and they were on the floor behind the dang refrigerator there.
Puck on the board. Yeah. What he's talking about is a magnetic thing with probably your name on it. Right.
Yep.
And so unlike the way we operate, you know, you in the Air Force, you knew what you were going to do 2.5 weeks in 3 weeks in advance. Right. Yeah. I mean, they schedule a month in advance. Yeah. Well, that's not the way we do it, as you know. I mean, we're doing good to figure out the next day.
You know? 1600 comes out tomorrow's schedule.
Yeah, it's a different, it's a whole different. Oh, and so let me ask you this. When you were in 533, VMFA, AW 533, did you have a side billet other than squadron pilot? What was it?
So I started off as the assistant OPSO, so the assistant operations officer, and then I went on to become the double AMO or the assistant aircraft maintenance officer.
Yeah,
which a lot of the Marines were not happy about me getting that job.
it's kind of a coveted, you know, it's kind of coveted job. Well, so that's different from Air Force Fighter Squadron, right?
Yep.
I mean,
Air Force.
You guys did almost no maintenance in the squadron, right? Is that the
Maintenance is not in the squadron. They're not integrated. They're separate chain of command, you know, separate groups and all that stuff. And so you don't really interact with them other than when you go down to, you know, to sign to get the jet, you know, and then for your little bit of maintenance debrief, once you're done, here's what's wrong with it. You know, and guys would go down there and you'd interact. And it's really weird too, because like when you deploy in the Air Force, like all of a sudden they all become one unit underneath the squadron commander for the flying squadron. But when you're back at home station, they're separate. So that was probably the best experience that I had out of that exchange program. Was just it taught me a whole lot more about leadership,
right?
And getting to work with the maintainers and everything that they do, you know, stuff that. If I tried to do that in the Air Force, I would get looked at really weird.
You know, because that's not normal.
It's just not normal to see somebody down there. You know, like if you ever saw like an Air Force officer out there doing a FOD walk, you know, it's like what the heck's going on? You know,
right?
But yeah, so that was a really good part of that assignment and those jobs that I had.
I got a lot more questions, but I think we need to
real quick
pause. Let's pause.
FOD is foreign object damage. So we're looking for a screw, anything that may be on the ground that could get sucked up by a jet engine and
there you go.
Cause a few million dollars worth of damage. So we had to walk around and look for that stuff. FOD walk.
Yeah. Is this a good time to take a quick break, Repeat?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's take a couple and a half minutes and point our listeners to some people who are going to offer them a good deal and in turn are offering us a great deal. So we'll be back in 2.5. Ladies and gentlemen, fasten your seatbelts and prepare for takeoff. Today's in-flight service includes a special feature. And no, I'm not talking about extra legroom. Better, amazing food. That's right, I'm talking about Flying High with Factor, the meal service that delivers delicious, chef-crafted, and dietitian-approved meals right to your hangar. I mean your home. You know, last week, my son and I were grounded at home with our stomachs in autopilot mode, no energy to go out, and definitely no fuel left in the tank for cooking. Sounds like the perfect storm, right? But Factor was there to save us from declaring minimum fuel. We taxied right over to the fridge and picked out a gourmet meal for each of us. I had the chicken with an artichoke and spinach sauce. It took my taste buds to new altitudes. And my co-pilot, I mean my son, devoured a pork chop with a cheese and barbecue sauce that was simply out of this world. That's what I call first-class dining. And with Factor, you don't need to be a flight engineer to prepare your meals. It's all about two-minute meals. Fuel up fast with restaurant-quality dishes that are ready to heat and eat from the refrigerator to the plate and ready to eat in under 3 minutes. And for those with early morning flights, Factor's got your back with pancakes, smoothies, and more. It's a whole menu designed to keep you fueled and ready for whatever the day throws at you. And the best part? No prep, no mess. It's like having your own personal crew in the kitchen. Factor meals are ready to heat and eat, leaving you more time for pre-flight checks or just kicking back in the pilot's lounge. Plus, Factor is as flexible as your flight schedule. Order as much or as little as you need each week with the option to pause or reschedule deliveries anytime. It's the perfect solution for anyone who is always on the move. And speaking of being on the move, it's now time to get yourself on the move over to your computer. Visit factormeals.com/sothereiwas50 to get 50% off your first box. That's right, half off. Head to factormeals.com/sothereiwas50 and use the code sothereiwas50 to get 50% off. That's code sothereiwas50 at factormeals.com/sothereiwas50 to get 50% off. So thank you to Factor for sponsoring that. So you were out doing the Hornet training. I think this is about as good a time as any to circle back to that intro story. Yes, because yes. I can't think of a more terrifying place on the planet to be than on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier, especially on your own, if you haven't spent any time out there.
Yeah. What led up to this? First of all, did they say, hey, Hoover, would you like to be carrier qualified? Or did they just say, hey, you're going to the boat, bro?
This is part of the program, man. I got the full enchilada from the training. You know, you can't get away from that.
Well, this is unique because, your peers, or everybody that was with you going through training had been there already.
Yep.
Right? In probably the T-45 Goshawk at that point.
Yeah.
And yeah, so they'd
all been there before. And so I will back up the story a little bit, because, you got to get on the boat somehow, right? And so they give you the opportunity, to say, okay, well, half the class is going to fly the jets out there and the other half, you're just going to walk on when it's in port here. Well, I got into that group of you're going to be the half that gets to walk on, right? And I've never been on freaking carrier before, so I have no idea how this thing works, right?
Big gray boat.
But a bunch of the instructors from 101, they were going out for some drinks. One of the bars there in Coronado, they said, hey, why don't you come with us, have some drinks, and then we'll all walk on, together at the end of the evening, once we know when we're all ready to go. Yeah. So I grabbed one of the other students in the class. I said, you're going to be my DD because none of the other students were invited to go hang out with the instructors.
Right. No.
So you, hey, come with me as a buddy of mine, So we go hang out and we're having drinks and stuff. And I'm like, so what time do we need to be there? And they're like, don't worry about it, man. As long as you're on before it leaves port, you're good. You know, like you just don't worry about it. And meanwhile,
they are setting you up.
Well, I knew I was probably okay because they were still there with me. Right.
Okay.
So I'm like, as long as the instructors haven't left, I'm probably safe. But in the meantime, my buddy, he's like, dude, we got to get out of here, man. We got to go. And eventually I am, you know, had way too many adult beverages.
Sure.
And so we make our way down to the port there and, you know, my buddy's trying to explain to me, okay, here's what's going to happen. You're going to walk up and there's going to be these sailors there and you're going to do this and that. And trying to explain that, number one, to an Air Force guy, but to an Air Force guy that's drunk was not like a good idea. And so as we're going up to the top, you know, of the, what's it called? The gangplank or whatever.
The gangplank.
You know,
gangplank.
We get up to the top of that thing. And sure enough, there's a little table there. And some sailors sitting there. And then there's this old guy in some PT shorts with like a Navy sweatshirt on standing off to the corner. And as we get up to the top, he's like, you two, come over here. I'm like, who is this old guy? You know? So we walk over there and he looks at us and he starts yelling. He's like, do you know what time it is? My buddy, he's just, you know, standing strict attention. And I like look at my watch and I was like, honestly, I can't even read my watch right now. I have no idea what time it is. And then he looks at me, he's like, what did you just say to me? I said, I can't read my watch, sir. And he's like, sir, you're GD right, sir. I'm the GD CAG of this ship. And like,
oh shit.
He starts going off and about, you know, all this stuff. And my buddy is just like, you can tell he's just like, can't believe this is happening. And as the middle of the guy's like standing like right there, you know, 6 inches from my face, screaming at me, like I raised my hand and he's like, what are you doing? I said, can I just interrupt for a second? I'm an Air Force guy. I don't know what's going on here. But my buddy said we just need to be on the boat
before it
leaves. I just want to get through all this or you know, something to that effect. And he looks at us and he looks at my buddy and you could tell he was trying so hard not to start laughing. And he looks at my buddy. He's like, get him to his room and I don't want to see you two again. And then that was my story for getting on the boat. And the funny enough though, the instructors, they were about, you know, 30 minutes behind us.
Oh shit.
They did not get the same treatment that I got. So, but
that's rich.
Yeah. So we get there and you know, and so now I'm sleeping it off, you know, and next day, I think it was the next day there was no flying. It was, you know, they were still going where they needed to or whatever, or I wasn't on the board or something. But then it comes my day to fly. And, you know, like you said, I've never been on a carrier deck before, let alone one out at sea. And so I have no idea what's going on. And I got, you know, down in the ready room and they're like, all right, here's your side number, which is, you know, the tail number of the jet you're flying, you know, and here you go. Here's what you're supposed to do. You're going to, you know, and the standard routine was you're going to take off and you come back around, you know, you do your trap and then you launch again. You keep doing that and get as many cycles as you can in, right? And I'm like, wasn't there going to be like an instructor with me or something for my first time? You know, and they're like, no, like, no. What do you need an instructor for? That's what we've been doing, you know, CQ practice, our field landing stuff, you know, for the past month. You know,
right.
I'm like, well, how am I supposed to like know not where to walk and not walk on the deck and stuff? They're like, well, just grab one of the, I think it was the, I don't even remember which color they are, the brown shirts or, you know.
Brown shirt or a green shirt.
Yeah. Grab one of the brown shirts and tell him where you're going. He'll make sure you don't die out there. You know? And so I crack open the door, the deck there, and I take a step out, you know, and the boat's moving, you know, and you're like.
Right.
And you got the wind rush, and then all of a sudden there's a jet that lands right in front of you. And I'm just like. Oh. Holy crap. Like, what have I gotten myself into?
you know,
I don't know what I'm doing here. And so sure enough, like, all right, let me find somebody that can help me make sure I don't run into anything and kill myself out here. And they got me over the jet. Wow. But that whole experience, you know, from that, and I still, you know, I remember almost all of it, you know, just sitting there trying to go through your normal startup sequence and pre-flight checks and all that stuff. And, you know, and jets landing right in front of you and you're just like, what the heck is going on? And it's so, okay, like I got to get back in my rhythm, do my checklist, do what I'm supposed to do, you know? And then you get out there. And then when you pull onto the cat, you know, for those that don't know, they've got like a whiteboard that they hold up with like a weight, right? So whatever you think your fuel weight is, so they can set the cat to the right power setting or whatever the right technology is there.
Put you off the right speed.
So you're supposed to look down at that, compare it to, you know, your aircraft fuel load and weight, and, you know, you tell them up or down or whatever. And I just remember looking at the board and I'm like, I don't know what's going on. I just give them a big thumbs up. I'm like, we're good, man. Like, I don't know. And I'm sure, you know, for the students is probably all set to be super conservative anyways, you know?
You bet. Yeah.
And so then you sit there and you do all, you know, you run up to full afterburner and you're sitting there and I've got my hand on the towel rack and I'm like, okay, I've saluted them. And now I'm like sitting here, I'm like, and it felt like forever. You know, first time you do something like that, you're just sitting there going like, this is, something's wrong because we're not going anywhere yet, you know? And then all of a sudden it kicks. And that is like, you know, an experience you will never forget if you, you know, once you do it. And I just remember, you know, oh shit, you know, so I'm going and we get airborne there and my Air Force habits immediately kick in. Cause as soon as I got airborne, what's the first thing I did? I raised the gear, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
And then I'm like, wait a minute. No, I'm not supposed to do that. Like, you know, so I put the gear back down, you know, turn back into the down one there to bring it back around and I land. And then you land, you know, you trap, you know, and I trapped on the first try. Like, okay. All right. Like, okay. I lived. Okay, I got to do it again now.
Okay, I live. I love it. Now I got to do it again. Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah,
so it's, what is it, 10 day traps and 6 night traps, I think it was. Yeah, so.
Did you do it all in one shot? Or no. The day traps?
No, I think it was, we did it 2 days. Because, you know, they do that thing where, you know, you've got to wait for the helicopter to land and, you know, in the middle of the cycle there or whatever. Yeah. And so.
That's.
Which boat was it?
I was getting ready to ask that. What ship?
Yeah.
The Lincoln, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
Okay. You said, I need to get clarification on something. I know what you're talking about. However, some of our listeners won't. You said hand on the towel rack.
Yeah. So they tell you, you know, when you're taking off on the cat, you're not supposed to have you're not supposed to hold on to the control stick there, you know, because they don't want you, you know, a reflex, you know, they don't want you to pull back on the control stick or whatever, or basically react to what's happening. So the trim is all set for takeoff. To where, you know, if you're not touching the control stick, you've got the left hand, you know, up in afterburner and the right hand is grabbing, you know, they call it a towel rack, but it's basically just a handle there. I guess you can, I never flew with a towel, but you could always, some guys do.
Yeah, it's a handle. It's a handle like up in the canopy bow, right?
Yeah, up on the canopy bow and you leave your handle there and then your hand's off and as soon as it launches, you know, because of the way the trim is set and the configuration of the aircraft, you climb away at a certain pitch angle, you know, and then, okay, like now it's stabilized. Now I've reached down and then you take over the controls and go from there.
Now,
right.
I'm going to say something. Well, I saw it go through some of our live chats going on here, but you know, you should wear wings of gold after that, because you know, you did it. Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
That's it.
Yeah, I'm very impressed, Hoover. That's a great story. But the fact that you didn't go to the boat as a student, you know, like we all did, and now you're just being thrown into this thing. It's impressive.
Well, like I said, I mean, that was one of the
you're kind of expected to know it.
Well, that was one of the big differences between, you know, how the Air Force does things and the way the Navy Marine Corps does stuff. And I mean, the Air Force never would have done that. You know, they would have said, okay, we recognize you haven't been to the carrier ever. So we're at least going to put, you know, Instructor Wizzo or somebody in your back seat to make sure you don't kill yourself on the, you know, on the first flight. But the Navy Marine Corps is just a little bit different in the way they do things. And that's okay too, you know? So it definitely builds a lot of confidence when you do it that way.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's
the other thing that you said was interesting was, something you do something like that, it's something you'll never forget, you know, if you hadn't experienced it before. And I still, 40 years later now, almost at least 35, remember my very first cat shot. It was in a T2 off the Lexington, and between the excitement of the moment and the air being forced out of my lungs, I was doing this high pitched like a 6-year-old girl coming off of there. That was such a hoot. And I think I would say 4 G's easily straight back as that thing shooting you down range.
Well, the Lexington had such a short cat stroke.
And then I thought my engines had quit. Yeah, the Lex was a shorter cat stroke. And then when I came off, it was relatively speaking so much quieter. I had to physically look down at my engine gauges and make sure I hadn't lost my engines. I thought, oh, they quit. And the relative acceleration was so much less. It almost felt like I was being thrown forward. And it was like, oh, no, they're still running. Okay, I'm good. that was nuts.
I'm very impressed by that, Hoover. So you show up in Beaufort at VMFA AW 533. Mm-hmm. And did you guys deploy while you were there?
We did one Westpac during that 2 years that I was there. So for those that don't know, Westpac is the, you know, we go out to Iwakuni in Japan where you're, you know, you kind of land based out of there. And then while we're at Iwakuni, you hop around to some of the different spots over there. So we went to Thailand and Malaysia, Singapore, Korea, and did all that stuff, you know, a couple weeks here and there at a time. So
did you guys get down to Darwin?
That was definitely a different experience too. So
did you get to Darwin while you were in?
No.
Okay. Did you say Kadena? Did you guys go down and operate out of Kadena a little bit?
We did. That's about as far as, I guess, I don't know if that's further south than Singapore, but that's, we did go down there.
What would you say? Oh, I'm sorry, Fig, were you going to stay on that line of questioning for a second?
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of curious as to what your impressions are about the two different airplanes, the Eagle and the Hornet. Two different missions and that sort of thing. But I'm wondering if you have, you know, is one your favorite over the other? I think I know what your answer will be, and I think I understand why, but they're such different airplanes, somewhat similar missions. Did you find one easier to fly, one more rewarding to fly? Can you talk about that for us a little bit?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I have to say, like, I really enjoyed flying the Strike Eagle more. But only because of, you know, the way they employ that aircraft and because of its capability. You know, it just enables it to do a whole different mission set, or at least a much, much longer missions and more complex stuff than what the Hornet is capable of, because it's just got such short legs with its fuel capacity and the limited amount of ordnance that you can carry on it compared to a Strike Eagle.
Right.
And so the one thing that I really liked about the Hornet was I really enjoyed doing all the FACA stuff, being able to control, you know, close air support missions from the air, from the cockpit, you know, and working directly with the ground forces and having that capability. Cause that is something that the Air Force doesn't do in the Strike Eagle. The A-10s do that. And I know some of the F-16 squadrons have the FACA qualification, but the Strike Eagle doesn't. And I really enjoyed the Hornet. The Hornet was a fun jet to fly, especially doing like slow flight BFM, one-on-one, you know, dogfights, you know, in close quarters, just because of the nose authority and the high AOA maneuverability of the aircraft. It was really, really neat to fly that thing, because the Strike Eagles, you know, you take the C model Eagle and then you slap on the conformal fuel tanks, you know, and then you slap on some external wing tanks is just not really made for, for dogfighting,
right?
Like that, you know. So I liked both of them, but in general, just the I felt
for like, different reasons.
Yeah, for different reasons, yeah. Though. But you know, you always, you know.
Well, yeah. You always like your first girlfriend, yeah, you know,
first,
always.
First true love.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, there's that. I felt like I was asking, you know, which child is your favorite? I get it.
Yeah, it's hard to say. But he did. He had a favorite. And I get it. Yeah. I mean, totally.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's really cool that you got that experience. That's it's rare. I don't know what percentage of, you know, I know a lot of Harrier guys, and only like three that I can think of did an exchange tour. And, you know, so it's pretty rare. I don't know if it, you know, everybody really knows that, but getting to do an exchange with another service or go to another country's service and do an exchange is pretty rare. It's a unique opportunity. I'm glad you got to do that.
We have, I know down at Beaufort, it was typically, you know, they'd only have one Air Force guy there at a time. So, you know, when I left, I got replaced with another Air Force guy, and, you know, you're competing with all the other fighter platforms too. So there's, you know, Strike Eagle guys, A-10 guys, and, you know, C model guys, all that stuff that want to do those types of things. They're interesting assignments because they're really good for, you know, a lot of fun, you know, I think for the pilot in terms of career development and putting you on specific track for like different leadership opportunities, things like that with the Air Force. Like they're not really so much good for that because they kind of take you out of the Air Force chain of command and out of the Air Force cycle for a 3-year period. And so you're kind of forgotten a little bit, you know, by the community during that time, you know, and so you're trying to kind of work your way back into things when you go back. But, you know, that's a whole nother discussion on officer development and, you know, what we should really be doing.
Now, just to clarify, there was one Air Force exchange pilot at Beaufort period or per squadron?
One at Beaufort. I was the only Air Force guy on the base. So
that's what I thought you were going to say. Yeah. That's pretty unique.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was weird, you know, because you're walking around, uniform looks a little bit different than everybody else's, you know, and then you've got the blue hat, you know, versus everybody else's green or tan hats, you know, depending on Navy, Marine Corps, you know.
Right.
So
now this is administrative and it really doesn't matter, but who does your OPR while you're, I mean, was it the Marines signing it or was there an Air Force? I mean, how'd that work?
That's part of the crappy part. Depending on how long the exchange program's been going, like some are more successful at doing this than others. But for the program that I was in down at Beaufort, I wrote my own performance report,
which
having no experience really writing those reports at that point, I thought I was writing like really awesome reports, but, you know, and of course the Marine Corps, they just sign off on them. Right. You know,
sure. Yeah.
And then the Air Force is like, you know, like, okay, now it's a part of my permanent record, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd find out, you know, 3 years later that like, I should have written those a little bit better if I wanted, you know, certain opportunities and things like that.
Doesn't walk on water every day, only 6 days a week. You know, wait a minute. What did you do wrong? Why weren't you walking on water 7 days a week?
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, because how the Air Force does all those compared to how the Navy and the Marine Corps handle performance reports is just completely different system and styles of writing and what they're looking for and stuff like that too. So
how'd you get, so you have a YouTube channel, Pilot Debrief. If folks, this is a fun channel to go learn about some really cool things in aviation. You cover a lot of really tough stories and you do it with grace. You know, I know it's got to be hard to hold your tongue sometimes, and other times it's just got to be heartbreaking to see what you're doing. But how did you get into doing the YouTube thing? Was it safety in the Air Force? Was it?
Yeah. So I got started and down the safety path towards the end of my career in the Air Force. And then one of my last jobs in the Air Force was the wing chief of safety. So in that job, you know, you're responsible for overseeing all of the aviation safety on base, all of the occupational safety. So all your OSHA compliance type stuff, as well as weapons safety. So basically anything that happens on that base, somebody gets injured, whether it's, you know, running a plane into something or, you know, falling off a ladder, you know, trying to paint the side of a building, you know, you cover all that stuff with the investigation. So So that's how I got started in that process. And I kind of liked it, you know, but I didn't ever really think I would be doing something like that outside of the Air Force. Yeah. And then, you know, I started, you know, I would see, as I'm sure you guys do, you see like aviation mishaps in the news and stuff like that. And, you know, then you have friends and family that kind of ask you about those things. And what do you, what do you think happened, you know, and let's talk.
And then the misinformation around them is always astounding.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And then, then you'd start, you know, I can't remember which one it was, but I remember, you know, at one point reading one of the NTSB final reports on, you know, some mishap that happened. And I remember reading it going like, really? Like, is that it? There's gotta be more to this story, you know? And then, and that led me to discovering, you know, well, the NTSB has a whole other site that has the docket, which is all of the supporting documents for the investigation, where they do the interviews and the analysis and everything else that doesn't make it into that final report. And then you start reading through some of that and you're like, well, holy crap, man. Like, why didn't they talk about this? Or why didn't they talk about that? You know? And the other thing that was kind of frustrating to me was, you know, you'd read the story about a mishap and it would say, well, you know, the probable cause was the pilot exceeded the critical angle of attack and he stalled. And you're like, well, no crap. Like, of course that's what happened. But like, how did he get to that point? Like, what did he do that caused him, you know, to get to there? And then that's when you like, you go, and it's maybe not in the final report, but you go back in the docket and you find out, well, this guy, like, you know, he wasn't even licensed to be, you know, wasn't even qualified to be flying the aircraft. And he had lied about this or that. And, you know, and oh, by the way, he didn't run any checklist, you know, and sometimes that stuff would make it into the final report, but a lot of times there's details that don't. And I've learned over the past year or so of doing this, that a lot of it's really dependent on the person at the NTSB that's doing that investigation and the level of experience they have and whether they include it or not. And so that's why I decided, you know, I said, all right, well, let's start an aviation channel. And let's talk about some of these things. And it really started with, well, let's try to explain these different ATC events, right? Air traffic control, where, you know, you have this, the air traffic controllers, you know, recording of the conversation, the radio calls and stuff, you know, for an aircraft that's having an emergency situation. So I start off making some videos of those, and those are some of the earliest ones on my channel. And then it evolved into what it is today, where, you know, I'm taking basically an NTSB investigation into something and then just doing a deep dive analysis. And really it's trying to find compelling stories and share as many lessons as I can from those stories, you know, cause one, you know, pilots appreciate them cause they know it makes them safer. Student pilots learn from them. I get also a lot of non-flyers watch the channel just because of the compelling nature of the story. Cause there's a certain human element to it. And
right,
that was the other thing that I found was missing with a lot of aviation content is nobody ever really talks about the victims, you know, of these things.
Oh yeah.
And well, how did these four kids end up on this plane? You know, like,
yeah,
probably shouldn't have been, you know, and here's what happened. So
that's always the heartbreaking too. When you see that, it's like people that have no control over whether they were there or not. And you're like, oh.
Yeah. Yep. So.
No, yeah, it's amazing. I highly encourage anybody to go look at Pilot Debrief on YouTube. Fantastic channel. Some good stuff. So,
yeah, my YouTube shorts are, end up being a little bit more lighthearted because it's really just talking about some of the stuff that I see in like, you know, a 30 to 60 second clip, you know, but it's the videos that do the deep dive type stuff. And I guess it's interesting because, you know, when I start doing the research, you know, I can get a little emotional sometimes because you're reading, you know, maybe the cockpit voice recorder of everything that was said all the way up to the moment of impact, and that's really hard, especially when you know, like everything that was done wrong that on that flight that they never should have been in that situation to begin with. But I was telling my wife, it's weird sometimes because I have to go through it so many times, either doing my research or doing the filming and the editing of the video, that by the time like I post that video, it's almost like, you know, it's a non-event, if you will, for me anymore. It's lost its emotional significance, you know, to a certain degree. But then people start commenting on the video, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, wow, yeah, that's right. Like, you know, and you're, it's like you're going through it for the first time again, because these people are seeing it for the first time presented to them. So
that's right. That's a lot of work. That's kind of a labor of love for you now, isn't it?
Yeah, I enjoy doing it. It's as sad as some of these are, I hesitate to say it's fun for me, but I do enjoy, you know, making that type of content and trying to simplify things and break it down. So,
well, you know, there's value in that as aviators, we can learn from other people's mistakes, you know, and you're just pointing out some things, and you know, there's non-aviators that are interested in this kind of thing, but truly it's, you know, it's valuable. And, you know, thanks for doing that.
But as they say, flight manuals are written in blood, right? So sadly, a lot of this is written in blood, and hopefully somebody can take that, take these all as learning points. So
yeah.
Well, I want to say, first of all, Hoover, it's been a pleasure. We've had you on here for an hour and 15 minutes, and it's gone. It seems like about 10 minutes to me.
Right.
I can listen to more stories forever, but I know you have a life. I want to say, thank you for your service, sir, and I really enjoyed our visit.
Yeah, well, thank you guys so much for reaching out to me and for the invite and for your service as well. I think you guys are doing an awesome job with the show. Glad to be a part of it. And yeah, I definitely could have talked for a lot longer and plenty more stories to share. But
well, you got to come back then.
So yeah, this is what happens always. Yeah. You know, as soon as we stop recording and you go to have a beer, you're going to think of seven things that you should have told us. So just write the bullets down and we'll have you back. Is that cool?
Absolutely. All right. Love to have you back.
Yeah, we'll make a plan for it.
All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to say a quick salute to all of our military veterans and their families who support families who support them in their important mission. And I want to say thank you for everybody out there.
Indeed. The families go unrecognized more than anybody. We also need to thank a couple other people. Thanks, of course, always goes out to Dave Hamilton over at Beckbeat Media, who has a show, The Mac Geek Gab, The Business Brain, and The Gig Gab for musicians.
And our advertising is handled by Beckbeat Media, beckbeatmedia.com. Thank you, Dave Hamilton.
Indeed. We have a glossary, so if we have a term like FOD or FAC or TOC or TAC or anything we didn't get it in there. Yeah, Talrac. Yeah. Shoot us an email and we'll get in there. You can go find that at sotherewas.us/glossary. And then how would someone write to us, Fig, to ask us about something on there?
Well, if you want a proper answer, a intelligent answer, you better address it to Sticks at he's in the background. I can see him. Sticks at sotherewas.us. And you can also reach Repeat at sotherewas.us and Fig at sotherewas.us. However, if you want a really good answer, you should address Sticks, because he is absolutely got a higher IQ than both of us put together.
Absolutely. One other thank you we need to get out there is to all our supporters online at sotherewas.us/Patreon. All the people taking their hard-earned money that they're paying taxes on, it's put in their wallet, and they turn around and frivolously throw it at us. We don't know why, but we're grateful that you do. We are humbled by your support, and it helps us keep these great guests coming to you every week. It's a big deal, and we're honored. So thank you so much.
Well, where are we at here? Hey, rate us. Rate our show.
Yeah.
Give us some feedback. If you've got actual feedback that's not five stars, tell us how we can get it to five stars. We're trainable.
We're trainable.
Yeah. For the most part.
Usually. Yeah. So there I was .us/rate. Yeah. So watching tonight, I saw him there in the background is Brad Silcott at BDSAviationPhotography.com. He lets us use a lot of his imagery. So indeed, thank you to him for letting us use some of those great photos. He takes some amazing shots, mostly down in the Eastern Carolina area. Got some great Harrier shots, but other naval aviation photos too. And I bet he even has a Strike Eagle or two in there somewhere.
I'll bet he does. I want to say, hey, thanks to Bago. Bago's in the background there somewhere. I don't think he's with us right now, but he's always back there doing stuff for us in the background. Thank you, Bago. Indeed.
Thanks for all his help, particularly over at facebook.com/sotherewas.us. He handles that page for us with grace, and he's on there a lot more than I can be. So that's deeply appreciated. Then two last guys we need to say our thank yous to, Fig.
Yes, sir. Well, their music's playing in the background there. Those are the two F-16 pilots that make the Air Force sound good, the Dos Gringos.
Dos Gringos. Go listen to them. They have a great song, in fact, about Air Force pilots wanting to land on a carrier. And our guest tonight did it.
Hoover can probably relate to that song very well.
Yeah, take it back. They want to take off from a carrier.
They don't want to land. Yeah.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's a great song. Yeah, thank you to the Dos Gringos.
Indeed. So, all right, everybody. It's been great being with you this week. We appreciate all your love and support. And until next week, stay safe and check six.
There I was, crossing the pond, and you could see that I wasn't exactly fond of all the shit I was wearing on that day. Now an F-16 is cramped enough, but it's even worse with all that stuff supposed to save your life. But we knew there was no way. 'Cause when you're going down the North Atlantic, man, it's over.
Hold on, what'd he say?
He said it's over.
Okay, that's a lawsuit.
What the hell?